Chapter 35. 3 days later. Shulik, Suevbrook Province. Brigadier Ivak Zalfa panned his telescope across the vista from his vantage above the valley, where the main road ran eastward from Shulik. Even from 2 miles away, he could see the jumble of belongings the citizens of the Suevbrook capital had tried to take with them, only to be discarded when word of an Arthani pursuit passed through the thousands of refugees. This part of the road was 10 miles from Shulik, and the abandoned baggage had gradually lessened the farther from the city they went. Resistance inside Shulik was quashed only the previous day. Although not that many of Suevbrook's fighting men had fought, they had been tenacious and had to be rooted out block by block. The delay had allowed most citizens to leave the city, though Zalfa wasn't discouraged because taking captives was not an objective and would only slow down their main mission, property destruction. General Okuyan had warned against indiscriminate killing. They wanted to put fear back into the clans, not incite them. Zalfa's ears picked up distant sounds of musket fire and the occasional 8-pounder. The smaller cannon were only recently cast and tested, ready for deployment. They hadn't brought horse artillery with them to Cadellium because it hadn't been deemed necessary. But just one of the surprises the island had presented to them, such as the clans being more capable than anticipated.
"Major," Zalfa said, not lowering the telescope, "I think it's time to pull back to Shulik. Resistance is increasing, and the latest reports say that Puritan Farkish men have started showing up. We knew this would happen eventually, and we're not here to engage in fixed battles with an increasing number of clansmen."
"Yes, sir. I'll give the order. I'll admit I was about to suggest it myself. This morning is the first time they brought artillery out. We lost 10 men to a grapeshot volley from 3 of their cannon when they ambushed a patrol scouting to the north. The officer in charge of the patrol estimated the cannon was somewhat lighter than our 8-pounders, maybe in the 6-pounder range."
Zalfa grunted.
"General Okuyan will not be happy to get this news. It was annoying enough that they had those abortions of light artillery at Moreland City and then captured some of our 12-pounders, and now they're casting their own. If they have 6-pounders, I'd be surprised if 12-pounders aren't coming along."
"One positive about the new Islander cannon showing up is that the men won't grouse as much when ordered to pull back," said the Major. "As the people fled Shulik, they dumped more of what they were carrying, and the pickings over the discards got better. One platoon found a chest of silver coins and almost got into a fight among themselves about how to divvy it up."
Zalfa allowed himself a smile. Looting was acceptable, if it didn't impact achieving objectives, something that this mission had more than accomplished. Zalfa and the other officers could afford to look the other way about sporadic pillaging. He put away the telescope and took his horse's reins from an aide.
"Let's get them pulling back, Major. I want everyone within Shulik by nightfall. We'll finish raising the city tomorrow and be back aboard ship the day after that. I think we've timed it right, and we'll have accomplished the maximum damage before the other clans can get here."
Town of Rexton, Iwell Province. Dennis Vega watched the last of the 800 Iwellese citizens leave the town of Rexton, 10 miles inside Iwell Province from the Keelan border. They took with them only what they could grab, as Dennis's men swept through the town at dawn and drove the populace to the north. What little armed resistance they offered was dealt with harshly and decisively. Otherwise, the Iwellese were unharmed physically. The emotional and economic consequences to the Iwellese people were not Dennis's concern.
"Sir Vega? Colonel Vega? Major Sixwith says the town is clear," said a captain.
The use of ranks was still new enough to Dennis and the men of the reaction force that all of them had to keep reminding themselves and one another to use the titles. Dennis hadn't understood the need for such labels, though he accepted Yosef's arguments about delineating specific numbers of men into groupings, such as squad, platoon, company, battalion, and as Yosef called the reaction force, a regiment requiring a colonel in charge. Thus, Dennis was a colonel. Colonel Dennis Vega, commanding the 1st Regiment composed of 1,200 dragoons, 26 pounders, and 100 support personnel for supplies and medical treatment. The full name was the 1st Mixed Dragoon Regiment. To recognize that its members came from different clans, though the exact membership changed as men rotated through the training, with the exception of officers down to the captains. These were on semi-permanent loan from their clans, part of the effort to get clans accustomed to working together. Dennis didn't attempt to follow Yosef's reasoning on the naming system, except that Yosef said only that another regiment forming near Kernford and composed entirely of Keelanders would be called the 2nd Regiment, or the 2nd Keeland Dragoon Regiment. The captain, a Guillemese, belonged to the battalion of Major Sixwith, a Keelander. The other battalion was commanded by Major Kildorn, an Orosian, and the artillery by another Keelander. That 2nd battalion and the artillery provided security west and north of Rexton, while Major Sixwith's men cleared the town.
"Tell Major Sixwith he has 30 minutes to start the fires and have his men formed on the road west," said Dennis.
There would be no looting. Nothing to slow their passage beyond the time needed to destroy what they could. When they left, the town of Rexton would be burning, and the citizens literally left with only the clothes on their backs. As far as Dennis was concerned, all Iwalese deserved whatever happened to them for betraying the other clans and allying with the Narthani. And they should thank God for the mercy being shown by the clans not killing all of the men. Dennis rode to Major Kildorn's position west of the town. He found Kildorn standing near a battery of 5 6-pounders, talking to the battery commander as smoke rose from Rexton.
"Colonel, I take it the town is cleared, and you've given the order to burn it?" asked Kildorn.
The major had taken to the rank structure and scrupulously used it.
"Yes. I gave Major Sixwith 30 minutes to finish and be here, ready to follow your battalion. Start forming up and signal to pull in the more distant pickets. Any interesting information from the Iwalese you questioned?"
A company of Kildorn's men had circled the town before daylight to block any escaping to the west with warnings. They didn't care about the north, because the nearest town that might have enough fighting men to be a threat lay 50 miles away. By the time word reached inland to the more populated parts of Iwal province, the reaction force planned to have completed their mission and be back near or inside Keelan province. The blockage had worked. They stopped close to 100 Iwalese heading west. Dennis hoped that none got through to sound alarms. Kildorn had instructions from Dennis to interrogate as many of the Iwalese men as he could in the time available.
"No information that might cause us to change the plan," said Kildorn. "The land is flat as we see it, almost all the way to the Preti border. There are 5 or 6 fishing villages, the men disagreed on the exact number. And no towns right on the water after this one. One of the men is from Neath, the Iwal town 18 or 20 miles north of the coast. He confirms the population there is about 3,000. They have about 200 fighting men in addition to any others who are willing to pick up a musket or sword. No regular Narthani are stationed there, although 50-man patrols pass through. If we stick to the coast, there's hardly anything to stop us until we reach Pomp, the town just over the border into Preti. Another man claimed there were 100 Narthani foot soldiers in Pomp. I would have expected their cavalry. However, Preti city itself is only 20 miles farther, and he confirms there's a shitload of Narthani there. He volunteered that the Narthani have had a hair up their asses, building fortifications all around Preti city, with what sounds like forts out as far as 10 miles from the city. An aide handed Dennis a quill and ink, and he pulled a map out of his saddlebag and made notations. "We won't get close enough to Preti city to stir up that nest. Ponth is our target. That's assuming we can move fast enough and surprise the Narthani. What about north of Ponth?
Three towns about the size of Rexton to the north and northwest of Ponth, said Kildorn. One is 10 miles away, and the other two a little farther.
Well, said Dennis, the closer one might get our attention. It will depend on what we run into. Our scouts are only 3 miles out from Rexton, which makes me uneasy, but we're assuming speed is better than being more cautious. Once we get to the Bready border, we'll push the scouts out to 10 miles and see what we shall see. At the first sign of serious opposition, we'll head back home.
Both sound good, said the Erosian Major. Destroying what we can and putting a scare into both the Iwalese and the Narthani, and then getting out with our skins intact.
Moreland Province, 5 miles from the Iwal border. Wellman Stent read, for the third time, the written message from Josef Kolsko. Between each reading, he looked again at the man who had given him the message and the four other men standing farther back, holding their horses' reins. The evident leader was of good height and a rangy build, but his distinguishing features were a facial scar and eyes that reminded Wellman of a predator. The other four men all appeared just as rough-looking, especially a short, wiry man with one hand heavily bandaged. Wellman Stent held the sheet in one hand and slapped it with the other. If this didn't come from Josef Kolsko, I'd know whoever thought this up is insane. Since it is Kolsko, I'll reserve that I only suspect he's lost his mind. And you're the idiots he's convinced to try this?
That's us, answered Balwis,
the description of himself and his four companions evidently having no effect. Wellman sighed and shook his head. If you're set out on committing suicide, who am I to naysay? I've enough to worry about, so you'll be on your own. I can't divert any attention or men. It will be hard enough controlling the mix of men I've got.
I noticed your men are riding under clan banners, Hetman Stent, stated Balwis.
Wellman grimaced. I know the rapid reaction force in Keelan has mixed up the men from different clans, but we started later and haven't yet had enough success in convincing the men to work together or take orders from someone of a different clan. I had no choice but to lead them in companies made up of just one clan.
I'm not sure which of us has the harder task, said Balwis.
It's going to take a lot more Narthani to give us trouble than it will for you, said Wellman. At first light tomorrow, we'll cross into Iwal territory and tear through several villages before getting to Hounslow. We know 2,000 Narthani had amassed there at one time. The latest word is that only about 1,200 remain. Of course, then there's the Iwalese, and probably another 1,000 or so fighting men in the city are nearby. Although the Iwalese pulled their people back farther into the province, they still patrol heavily, mainly at the border and around Hounslow. If you can slip through the border patrols, you might get to within a few miles of the city, though it's far too risky if you ask me.
Not your concern, Hetman.
The most I can do for you is let you talk to my man who has led a group watching the Iwalese patrol the border. We never see Narthani cavalry, except near Hounslow, and the Iwalese patrols cover only about a mile from the border. Farther into Iwal, they don't patrol. He can tell you the best times to slip through. Once there, it's a clear path to Hounslow if you travel at night and avoid main roads. The Narthani are mainly foot soldiers, though an escapee has reported they've been training more of their infantry to ride horses. The only cannon they have are their standard 12-pounders, like the ones we captured at Moreland City. They are not suited to accompany their cavalry or our dragoons, so we should be able to fight off any Iwalese attack and outrun any Narthani we don't want to confront. My intention
is to circle the city at about 10 miles, razing villages, burning bridges and crops, and doing whatever damage we can. We'll faint at Hounslow if the opportunity arises and we're not threatened. But our purpose is to arouse and threaten, not get into a serious battle.
Thank you, Hetman, that's useful. However, I think we can also help you, asserted Balwis. If we're successful, there should be chaos among the Nathani leadership, and they might hesitate to send men outside the city walls until the leadership is more organized.
If you're successful, that may be true, said Wellman, his manner making it clear he had slim expectations of Balwis and his men completing their mission. Although you might be lucky. From the clouds we see coming from the south, there's a good chance of rain over the next couple of days. This time of year, the rain comes in waves in this part of Cadellium. Assuming you get past the patrols, and assuming no one sees you before you get to Hounslow, and assuming the gap you say is in the city wall above the river is still there, then who knows? Maybe then your chances of coming out of this alive are somewhat above zero.
Good luck to you also, Hetman, said Balwis, smiling.
We'll grab some sleep, and then, if your man can help us through the Iwali's patrols, we'll try to reach within a few miles of Hounslow before nightfall. Depending on weather and if we can find the way inside, we'll act and be out of the city before light. With your move into Iwal, we suspect they won't be as committed to searching for us as they otherwise would have been.
Wellman shook his head once again.
God go with you. You're going to need all the help he can give.
Narthani Headquarters, Predi City. Administrator Nizam Tuzir had dressed as impeccably as always, although Akuyan detected an unusual edge to the overseer of non-military personnel in Cadellium.
The civilians are nervous, General, as I've reported before. Not unexpected, what with Zalfa away with 2,500 men, leaving fewer regular troops visible, plus the militia training and fortification construction contributing to the unease. No disturbances, but there's no question everyone knows things aren't the same as 6 months ago. One upside is that merchants and the more highly placed Nathani have made fewer petty complaints. I doubt they see their own problems as any less important, but at least they aren't as persistent as before.
Akuyan appeared attentive to Tazir's report, though his mind was elsewhere, particularly 300 miles north-northwest of the capital of Swaybroke Province. The regular command staff meeting would go on as always, minus two members. Brigadier Ivak Zalfa, who commanded the attack on Swaybroke, and Admiral Morfred Culkin, naval commander of the mission to Cadellium. Akuyan missed both Culkin and Zalfa at staff meetings. Culkin's perennial good humor and Zalfa's capability always reassured him. Not that the three other military men attending today were incompetent. None of them would have passed Akuyan's approval otherwise. Ketan and Metin were solid colonels. Ketan might rise higher, but Akuyan had identified him as an officer to take along to his next command and believed Ketan would make a superb engineering brigadier for a corps. In comparison, Metin also functioned as a respectable regiment commander, although Akuyan doubted he would rise further. Erdalin, the outlier of the three colonels, was personally brave, just short of reckless. He had also shown more decisiveness at Moreland City than Akuyan would have expected. Despite it being his wing of the deployment that suffered the clan's flanking attack, Erdalin had responded quickly enough to save the day from being a complete disaster. However, Akuyan disliked the man personally and had to keep that opinion from slipping into his evaluations. Erdalin might rise higher and serve the Empire well, though not again under Akuyan. Akuyan turned to Assessor Sadik Izer.
Any more news about the strike team, Sadik?
Still only the one for Skooks,
The team got back to their sloop with only 2 losses and 3 wounded. The Hetman was killed for certain, and they think possibly one of his sons. As for the other 2 teams, no word yet. The sloops will stay on station for another 6 days. If they aren't contacted by the team, they'll return here. Akuyan didn't bring up the part of the Skook's team leader's report that stated, matter-of-factly, that all persons at the site of the attack had been killed. Akuyan knew from pre-mission planning that the Skook's Hetman had been at a daughter's home. If all died, that included the Hetman's wife, his daughter and her husband, their 6 children, and whatever servants, guards, and other families were unfortunate enough to be present. He hadn't said anything, except to his wife Rabia, to whom he wished the Hetman's younger grandchildren had been spared. Akuyan shifted in his chair and tried to put unpleasant images from his mind. 1 out of 3 is still a success, Sadik. Along with the Swaybrook attack, these should cause the clans to pull inward to protect their own. Akuyan saw no reason to express his concern that the exact opposite might result. Instead, he voiced optimism. Last reports from IVAC stated that all had gone well, and they would finish destroying everything within 20 miles of the Schulich Harbor, and be back aboard ship no later than tomorrow afternoon, then back here by the next morning.